Okay. Good evening, everybody. It's great to see such a good turnout for this lecture. My name's Chris Hughes. I'm a professor in the International Relations Department, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Giorgio Sciani, who's with us for a year as a visiting fellow in our Center for International Studies. He's normally based at the International Christian University in Tokyo, which has an interesting history to it, I guess, and plays an interesting role in Japan. And he's one of the relatively few people, which is very surprising these days, one of the relatively few people in IR who actually takes religion seriously, not just as a problem, but as a part of human experience, and has written widely on the subject of religion, identity, international relations, and human security. He's the author of two books. The first one was Sikh Nationalism and Identity in a Global Age, and the most recent one is this one here, Religion, Identity, and Human Security, and there are some flyers going around. Highly recommended, and I think this will be the basis of your talk today. He's also very active in international relations activities around the world as president of the Asia-Pacific region of the International Studies Association. So it's really a great pleasure for us to have him here, and we're very grateful to him for giving this lecture, which is going to be discussing rethinking security along post-secular lines by taking into account the importance of culture, religion, and identity. So we have about 1.5 hours, and I guess you're going to talk for about 40 minutes or something, and then we'll have questions and answers after that. So welcome, Giorgio. Yeah.
Well, first, thank you very much to Professor Chris Hughes for not only a wonderful introduction, but a summary of my talk. You can probably go home now. That's really all I've got to say. And also to the hospitality of the Center of International Studies here at LSE, particularly Sophie Wise, who's put everything together logistically, and Professor Bill Callahan, who is the director. It's a great honor for me to be able to give a public lecture here at LSE. I was a student a couple of decades ago here, and it's a great honor to be able to come back and to give a public lecture, particularly in front of people who taught me and formed my ideas. So Professor Hayo Krumbach, who's sitting sheepishly at the back row. So basically, one of the themes I'm going to touch on will be the responsibility to protect. And I think it's, as an LSE product, LSE shares partial responsibility for what I say. So if there's anything you object, then please take it up with
me. I'm not going to protect you.
Okay. So the topic of today's lecture will be religion, migration, and human security. My book was Religion, Identity, and Human Security. The two reasons why I'm looking at migration. So the first is that I am a migrant. I live and work in Japan. My father was a migrant from Punjab between India and Pakistan. He was born in what became Pakistan and was both a refugee and a migrant before the term was coined as a result of partition. He moved to the United Kingdom in the 1950s and was a migrant there. Now, I've moved to Japan, and so in a way, by talking migration, what I don't want to do is to objectify and talk of others and talk in terms of what we should do for them. I'm talking from a specific subject position, the subject position of being a migrant, and I realize that I'm a very privileged migrant. I'm in a privileged position. At the same time, where I'm coming from is from the subject position of being a migrant. I had something which I wanted to share with you. It may be a bit too long, but I'll try anyway and cut down the theory later. My daughter, who's thoroughly Japanese, started a school in Barnet, Whitefield School, which had 40% ethnic minorities. Basically, what Barnet do, and I hope this isn't recorded, is they dump all the ethnic minorities in one or two schools, which have an overrepresentation of people from different parts of the world. And I was helping her with her English homework when I came across a particular clip from YouTube, which really spoke to what I wanted to say. And it may be a bit too long, but I'd like to see if this works. If not, I'll just go on and bore you to death talking about the theory.
He said those goddamn Pakistanis and their goddamn corner shops built a shop on every corner, took our British workers' jobs. He said those goddamn Chinese and their goddamn China shops. I told him they're from Vietnam, but he doesn't give a toss. I ask him what was there before the damn Japan man shop. He looks at me and dreams a scene of British workers' jobs. Of full-time, full employment before the goddamn boatswain came, where everybody went to work for full-time, full weeks every day. A British business stood there first, he claims, before the Irish came. Now British people lost their jobs and bloody Turkish there to blame. I ask him how he knows that fact. He said, because it's true. I ask him how he knows that fact. He said he read it in the news. Every time a Somalian comes here, they take a job from us. The mathematics, one, from us to them, it just adds up. He bites his cake. He sips his brew. He says again he knows this plot. The goddamn Caribbeans came and now good folk here don't have jobs. I ask him what was there before the goddamn Persian curtain shop. I show him architecture's plans of empty goddamn plots of land. I show him the historic maps, a bit of sand, a barren land. There was no goddamn shop before the Pakistani came and planned. Man, I am sick of crappy mathematics, because I love a bit of sums. I spent 3 years into economics and I geek out over calculus. And when I meet these paper claims that one of every new that came takes away one's daily wage, I desperately want to scream your maths is stuck in primary.
Okay, I think we've got the point. I was really quite moved by listening to Holly McNeish, and what she focuses on is very much the mathematical basis, the faulty mathematical basis of a lot of the debates on migration, which is based on a zero-sum game. Somebody coming from abroad takes away somebody's position or takes away somebody's job. And looking at most of the media debates, particularly here during Brexit, I was struck by the prevalence of that logic. We haven't seemed to have gone beyond this understanding of migration being a zero-sum game. So the sort of in terms of international relations, migration obviously has security implications. Since 2013, over 50 million people have been displaced, as we'll see later, mainly by wars in the Middle East, but also by the inequities of a global capitalist economy. We've had a disproportionate amount of migration from Islamic cultural zones, which has been increasingly securitized after 9/11. The recent terror attacks in Paris and Brussels have led to revival of Huntington's infamous Clash of Civilizations thesis, which is based on the idea that in the kernel of every cultural civilization, there are a set of religious values which are mutually exclusive. And we see the rhetoric of the Clash of Civilizations echoed in the recent presidential debates. And a racialization of migration. I gave a paper earlier last week on ontological security, and I feel that coming back to Britain, I feel far more ontologically secure because not only is my father othered as a migrant from South Asia, but my mother is as well. As a result of Brexit, we have increasing racialization of Europeans as well. The racialization of migration allows the construction of communities based on the idea of the migrant playing the role of the other. Okay, in terms of the terms which I'm going to use throughout this lecture, What I'm not trying to do is to try and categorize or to try and create a particular definition, but at least give you some sort of signposts of what I mean by the terms which I'll be using. So a religion, you can't really define it, but and it shouldn't be defined or categorized. But my understanding is anything to do with the sacred. So a symbolic system dealing with the sacred as opposed to the profane, which gives meaning to believers. Believers in don't have to be consciously to be believers. One of the key properties of attributes of a religion is its embodied nature as lived experience. There is a cognitive kernel, perhaps, to some understandings of religion or world religions, but religion is something which is lived, something which is embodied, something which is performed, and something which is part of everyday life. It can't be, as we'll see later, segregated or separated from what it is to be human. Migration, in this sense, refers to the movement of a person or a group of persons, either across an international border or within a state. And I think it's important to note that if we look at the movement of populations, the vast majority of movement is not across international borders, but within borders. So particularly within India and China, we find a great deal of population movement, people moving the countryside to go to cities to work. And by human security, which I work on, the UN General Assembly very helpfully gave us a two-page definition of what human security is. The only thing which I took out of it from it was the idea of the right of people to live in freedom and dignity. Everything else sort of contradicted one another. However, as you'll see later in the lecture, I think human security is a term which is interesting, which allows us to reconceptualize the relationship between self and other. Okay, just a bit of statistics, since migration is part of the title. When we talk in terms of the migration crisis, this is really what we're talking about. If we look at IOM statistics, until June 2016, you had 316,000 arrivals by sea, compared to 1 million in 2015, 3,000 dead or missing. 60% of the arrivals come from the top 10 refugee-producing countries. And if we look at them, so the Syrian Arab Republic, Afghanistan and Iraq, well, as we'll see later, there have been civil wars, which haven't been so civil, which have resulted from external intervention in at least three of them. What's so interesting, Lee, is numbers of migrants from Eritrea and also Ethiopia, most of them going to Italy, and there's a colonial history there, which isn't part of the Italian national story. Most of the migrants from sub-Saharan Africa go through Libya and are trafficked or moved to Italy and are interned in islands in Lampedusa. So this is what we mean by the crisis. What has the EU done about it? Well, quotas. So we've had a series of proposed quotas for relocating the hundreds of thousands of migrants who are trapped in economically arguably underdeveloped areas of Europe, in Greece and southern Italy. Following the closure of the wall, the Hungarian border in 2015, we've had proposed additional quotas for relocating migrants from Hungary as well. So we find the economically developed areas of Europe are taking the most amount of migrants. However, what I would like to question is really whether this is a crisis. So if we look at the percentage of immigrant or foreign-born populations within Europe, we find a steady increase. However, I mean, if we look at Switzerland, it's 29.6% of the population of Switzerland were born outside Switzerland. They're not part of the EU. Most of them are members who are non-citizens, but foreign populations who migrated from Italy, from Turkey, and from former Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. So many of them are EU citizens. But if we look at crisis, there's a question of crisis. What crisis? If you look at the percentage point change in immigration populations between 2010 to 2015, we find that the increase has been incremental. It hasn't been this sort of swarm which it's been presented in most of the mainstream media. And in many cases, you've seen a decrease in the number of migrants, of foreign-born populations within Europe. So why is this a problem? In terms of the solution to the problem, or the so-called problem of migration, the key strategy used has been to view migration as an external threat, as a short-term external risk or threat. So migrants have been securitized. As I will argue, this leads to an objectification and dehumanization of migrants. In Giorgio Agamben's work, we look at the idea of homo sacer, of bare life, of human beings being stripped or reduced to the bare functioning of what it is to be human. As I'll argue later, this is also a function of human security discourse, but objectification and dehumanization is part and parcel of securitization policies. The focus on security also indicates a failure to see the migration crisis as a global crisis with roots in the wars on terror waged by the West and Russia. I think if we look at Russian participation within the Syrian conflict, it's difficult to talk in terms of just support for the Assad regime. They're actually doing the bombing, just as we've seen the West play a key role in the overthrow of Gaddafi, his regime, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Migration should therefore be broadly understood in systemic terms as an inevitable consequence of these wars. Jason Burke has coined the term the 9/11 wars rather than the wars on terror, and also as a result of neoliberal globalization. By neoliberal globalization, I mean a globalization of neoliberalism or globalization of capitalism, which can be differentiated from, let's say, the authoritarian or state capitalisms which you have in China and increasingly, I would argue, in Japan. Another feature has been, and this is where religion comes in, has been an Islamization of migration. The majority of migrants, as we've seen, are Muslim from Islamic cultural zones. And we've had a post-9/11 narrative of good Muslim, bad Muslim, superimposed on migrants, refugees. This comes from Mamdani's work after the war on terror. The idea is that there are good Muslims and there are bad Muslims. The bad Muslims are always bearded terrorists. They're usually male. The good Muslims are the women and children who need to be rescued from the evil Taliban or from Saddam Hussein, etc. So if we look at refugees are seen as good migrants. There's a feminization and infantilization of migration, women and children fleeing civil wars who are duped by evil traffickers. And migrants, economic migrants, homo economicus, men from Africa and South Asia seeking employment, taking advantage of this swarm, this tide of people heading into Europe. So we again have this dichotomy, refugees as victims, migrants as parasites. If we look at some of the discourse which was used in 2005 by David Cameron and others, it was to talk in terms of migrants as basically a swarm of bees. There have even been comparisons to cockroaches. Again, if we look at the discourse, it's again a good-bad sort of relationship superimposed upon the refugee-migrant debate. implications for security. Well, the globalization of neoliberalism is transforming the role of the state in the global political economy. The state was part of, played a key role in dissemination of capitalism globally, but now the state has become a problem. Its main function is to keep people inside and to allow capital to flow outside. But if we look at if we expand the scope of security and look at security in ontological grounds, migration from particularly Islamic cultural zones is posing a challenge to the identity of what it is to be European. The secular, and I'll argue increasingly a Judeo-Christian identity of Europe and of the nation state. I think if we are to take Schmitt's argument that the state is a secularized theological concept seriously, then the universalization of the nation state system throughout the world can also be seen as a contribution to a Christianization of the world. So the argument here is security threats can no longer be contained within the territorial borders of the nation state. Okay, this allows us to talk in terms of human security. So in terms of my own vantage point, human security at least attempts to get away from securitization. So the human security approach focuses on the security of migrants rather than borders. It is based on the assumption that the individual is the main referent object of security rather than the state. So states and supranational organizations derive their legitimacy from their ability to protect the populations which they control. The narrow approach to human security attempts to protect populations from violent threats. By violence here, we're talking in terms of physical acts of violence. So we see this in the human security network, the idea of responsibility to protect. The Canadian government has also been vocal, certainly the Liberal government a couple of decades ago under Lord Axworthy, on advocating the narrow approach of human security, which does allow for international humanitarian intervention. So the idea is if you don't protect the population under your control, then outside intervention is necessary, or at least is permitted. The broad approach to human security, on the other hand, looks at the protection of the vital core of all human lives in ways that enhance human freedoms. Now, the term the vital core, I think, was part of the Commission for Human Security report, and it has theological connotations. I believe the person who came up with this, Sabine Alkire, was a theologian at Oxford, but I may be mistaken on that. But the idea of a vital core is quite similar to Anthony Giddens' idea of a protective cocoon, something which allows one not only to live life as a sort of a bare life, but one which allows one to live a life in which one can achieve things, human flourishing, in other words. So the idea of human security is that it involves the protection and also the empowerment of individual human beings. So part of the arguments from the broad approach to human security is that the protection is not enough. Empowerment is also necessary in order to free people from want and from fear. There needs to be a commitment to education, a commitment to healthcare, etc. However, if we are to apply this to migration, to the migration crisis, then we can see from the narrow approach, migrants will be seen as refugees rather than external threats, fleeing from violent threats from states, non-state actors, traffickers, and outside intervention. Whereas from the broad approach, migrants are seen as fleeing from unemployment, poverty, disease, ethnic and gender-based discrimination. Under both approaches, there's an objectification of the migrant. The migrant needs to be protected and needs to be empowered. So we have an objectification and dehumanization of migrants. And I think this is part and parcel of a security discourse. This is what security or securitization does. Anything with security in it contributes to an objectification of the other. There's a self-other distinction built in conventional understandings of security. So if we were to look at human security within a context of the development of humanitarianism and human rights and development within the past 100 or 200 years, it has antecedents in the prior processes of colonization. So human security can be seen in terms of a latest installment of a civilizing mission. It seeks not only to protect but to empower the individual who is freed from the shackles of culture and religion. So there are obvious parallels here with the civilizing mission, which sought, in the words of John Hobson, to impose a cultural conversion of non-Western states to Western civilizational standard. Now, what this allows us to do is to understand imperialism within cultural terms. Imperialism is not just about the imposition of a direct political economic rule upon a particular society, but it's also about the imposition of certain norms. These norms and these values can themselves be internalized. And I think at the very basis of international relations, if we look at Hedley Bull and Adam Watson's work on the expansion of international society, is a universalization or an expansion of a set of Western civilizational norms and their globalization. Human security is just the latest installment of this. What it does not allow is for the cultural dimensions of the human, of human existence, to be taken into account. We again get the idea of, if we look at the work of Stephen Hopgood, of the unencumbered individual. The unencumbered individual is, again, an individual who is detached or forcibly separated from the cultural and social milieu within which they were allowed to realize themselves as human beings. So the cultural or protective cocoon, if we go back to Giddens, which permits human flourishing, is taken away. So what should we do with human security? Should we just look at a different term? Should we ignore security? My argument is that, following the work of critical theorists, we can do something with it rather than merely reject it and to coin a different vocabulary which may have similar contradictions built into it. We can look at ways in which, I wouldn't say to fix or to solve it, but we can look for possibilities for its reconceptualization that are imminent within it. And I think imminence is quite important because, as we'll see, it's an important term when we look at religions. If we understand human security as the right to live in freedom and dignity, free from poverty and despair, then it allows us, particularly the term dignity, to bring in different cosmologies, different ideas of religion. So religion may be seen as an important source of human dignity and therefore of security. Before I go into the post-secular, I think we should sort of unpack the term religion. So in the previous talk, I looked at the difference between thin and thick understandings of religion. And I think one misunderstanding, it's also in the book, is that I'm privileging a thick understanding of religion over a thin understanding of religion. So if we look at a thick understanding of religion, this is where religion is part of an ordered archive of life, which allows an individual to gain a sense of security, ontological security, as being as a human being. It's related to the idea of faith acting as an anchor, which permits ideas of human flourishing. Thin religion, on the other hand, these are terms which Sudipta Kavaraj coined, may be seen more mainly as the politics of identity. Ideas of a religion in which, let's say, if we look at South Asia, the Hindu-Muslim divide is based not on following a particular cosmological understanding of what it is to be Hindu or Muslim, but not being Muslim or not being Hindu. So in this sense, if we look at religion, you know, that distinctions can be made between not the degree of religiosity. This isn't like a good bad Muslim divide, but the point I'm trying to make is much of what we understand by religion today, particularly the way it's politicized, is based on a misunderstanding of religion. Religion as thin religion. So in a previous public lecture, I think by Fawaz Gurgez, who an LSC professor, which I attended, the argument was very much based on the lack of knowledge of ISIS, for example, or Daesh, in terms of the lack of theological training compared to let's say, the ulema. They're not Al-Azhar trained scholars. So I think when we do look at incidents of religious violence today, we need to question the role which so-called religion plays within this. Having said that, I need to use religion as a category. I can't deconstruct religion until the final slide, because that doesn't allow us to get on to the idea of the post-secular. And I think it's important for us to understand the complexities and the contradictions inherent within the post-secular. So the post-secular was, I wouldn't say coined by Habermas, but certainly Habermas's work has allowed us to think in terms of, or to take post-secular, the term post-secular seriously. Habermas really sees post-secularism as a continuation of the Enlightenment project. Post-secular basically means that the Enlightenment project cannot, you know, that there's still people who are resistant, not necessarily migrants, but there's still religious people who are resistant to being emancipated, being empowered. What do we do about them? Well, what we should do in order to allow them, in order to integrate them within a particular polity, is to allow them to translate their religious-based claims, claims which come out of their own cosmologies, into terms which are intelligible to us. In order for them to do that, they need to express it within secular terms. There needs to be an element of translation which is necessary. So the argument which I would make in contrast to Habermas is that if we go back to the idea of thick and thin religion, then those religious subjects with who do things for whom religion is basically an anchor for which every aspect of daily life is linked. I'm thinking very much of South Asian societies, but also could be in Japan, where you have ideas of ritual. Ritual are a very important part of religion as a lived experience. Now, it's very difficult for these claims which emanate from a particular ritual, to be translated into secular terms without doing violence to what can be considered the vital core of faith, the vital core in the sense the protective cocoon of what permits a particular individual as part of a community to achieve a sense of security. So if we are to take Habermas's argument seriously on post-secularism, then what he is seeking is to create a space where religious and secular claims enter into dialogue as moral equals. So my argument here is that it's impossible for religious minorities to enter into a dialogue as a moral equal if they have to translate their faith-based claims into a language which the majority, the secular majority, understand. It does violence to their own understanding of their tradition. Okay, only a couple more slides to go. This one is, I just put this in to confuse you, and also it also, wherever I've gone and showed this, it's elicited a lot of controversy. I'll tell you what I'm not trying to do, and then perhaps I can tell you what I'm trying to do. It's easier to explain what I'm not trying to do rather than what I'm trying to do. What I'm not trying to do is to try and definitively sort of categorize meanings of human security from all of these different traditions. What I'm trying to do is basically to provincialize, using Chakravarti's term, conventional secular understandings of human security, particularly by looking at ideas of freedom and security. So if you look at secular discourse based on the idea that we live within immanence, within a framework of immanence. Charles Taylor introduced the term the immanent frame, where there's no possibility of transcendence. Freedom is understood in terms of rights, and security is provided by the state or by an institutional architecture in which nation states play a key role, such as the UN. The main community here is humanity. But the point I'm trying to make is this secular understanding of human security can be counterposed to other understandings of security which come from different cosmologies or philosophies. Now, the point I'll make in the next slide is that there is a reason why Christianity comes after secularism, which is that our understanding of the secular is one which is very much has been formed by the experience of a particular part of the world and a particular cosmology. So secularism, if we look at the work of Taylor, Talal Asad, and Jose Casanova, emerged from Christianity. The very term secular referred to priests who, lay priests or lay monks, who were part of a particular community rather than secluded in a monastery. So if we are to talk of the term the post-secular, then this is presupposed on a prior Christianization of the world, a Christianization of the world in which I think international relations has played a key role. So there are limits here in the possibility of desecularizing human security. So I've tried to look at the idea of post-secular human security. How can we desecularize it? Now, the first is that religion, particularly in a thin sense, can be seen as a source of cultural violence, masking patriarchal power relations and legitimizing homophobia. I don't want to equate religion with the particular practices of people who claim to be religious, but this is something which qualifies an operation, a way of bringing religious faith-based claims into public discourse. There's some practices which are legitimized by religion, which members of a particular society may find offensive. Secondly, the point I tried to make earlier, the religious-secular dichotomy is itself a product of Enlightenment thought, which is linked to transformations within a particular cosmology, within Christianity. And if we look at Derrida's work, the argument here is that the whole concept of religion itself is untranslatable. It's a Judeo-Christian concept, although, interestingly, he's using it, the Latin term, which is more equated with ideas of citizenship. So the Judeo-Christian concept of religio cannot be translated into non-Abrahamic cultures, so we cannot even talk in terms of religion as cosmologies, and we can't bring religion into play, into international politics. Therefore, religion is alien to most non-Western societies, even though it continues to define their subjectivity as it was imposed by colonialism. So these are all problems of operationalizing post-secular human security. So, in a way, why bother? Well, let's look at the difference between secular approaches to a migrant crisis and what I'm trying to see in terms of a post-secular approach to a migrant crisis. We look at two recent books, the first by David Miller, Strangers in Our Midst. This is a particular secular approach to the migration crisis. The immigration policy of a liberal democracy should be guided by what he terms weak cosmopolitanism. Weak cosmopolitanism is based on recognition that we're all human beings, national self-determination, fairness, and social integration. Of key importance is the right of a particular nation state to determine who comes in to its borders and who doesn't, and what criteria they have to fulfill in order to be considered citizens. Now, taking somebody with a diametrically opposed religious view, Slavoj Žižek, for Žižek, one in his final chapter, What is to be Done, in very Leninist terms, one has therefore to do two things. First, formulate a minimum set of norms that are obligatory for everyone without fear that they appear Eurocentric. And second, within these limits, unconditionally insist on toleration of different ways of life. These are secular approaches. The idea is you can come in, but if you come in, you have to play by the rules of the game, and we decide the rules of the game. The onus is very much on migrants to integrate into nation states, and this reproduces the importance of nation states in our imaginary and makes the nation state more and more central to our lives. Okay, what would a post-secular approach to the migration crisis be? Question mark, I have no idea. But I thought about this and said, how do we apply it? Firstly, we decenter the idea of the nation state. Migration should be viewed as a global crisis, not as a national crisis. The vast majority of migrants or refugees are still housed within the global south. The majority of Syrian refugees are in Lebanon, 1.5 million. The majority of Afghan refugees are in Pakistan. This is part of a global crisis, which brings into question the whole Westphalian order of territorialized nation states. The cultural particularity of migrant population needs to be recognized. They're not here because they want to be like you. They are here because of push and pull factors, because they want work, because they are forced to flee as a result of physical threats of violence, because of external intervention, because of environmental problems. Why should a migrant give up their own particular cultural particularity? Seen in my own terms, I'm a voluntary migrant within Japan. I can understand the idea of having to, let's say, learn a particular language, the language of a particular state, to learn Japanese in this sense. But this doesn't necessarily mean that I need to adapt myself to what would be seen as Japanese modes of behavior. I need to respect the culture, but at the same time, I don't need to integrate within a culture or within the dominant ethnic community within that culture. I should be able, through language, to articulate difference, my difference from the dominant culture, and still be accepted as part of that society. Thirdly, claims articulated in religious terms should not necessarily be translated into a secular idiom. Translation is suspiciously like assimilation. A secular idiom, if we look at the genealogy, the secular, and we locate it within a particular cosmology, the Judeo-Christian cosmology, then secularization involves, as I previously mentioned, the prior Christianization of the subject. And I think we should respect the claims of those who don't want to be Christianized, who don't want to be secularized. At the same time, however, these claims must be intelligible. So again, we need to think of a different conceptual vocabulary. And I think one of the uses or utility of using a post-secular approach is that it brings into question the entire basic unit of international relations. It basically brings into question the idea of political community. And I pose this as a question, but perhaps political communities, in order to provide human security for migrant populations, the identities of those communities need to be redefined or transformed. Now, very controversially, this could be a case of saying, okay, forget about ISIS, forget about Daesh in terms of the appalling acts which it inflicts on the minorities which live in the territories which it control, but take the idea of a caliphate seriously. The logic of being wedded to a secular Westphalian order is what's happening in Syria today. So if we look at the logic of national self-determination, there isn't really a question. Assad has the right to do what he wants within a particular territory, the territory which he controls as the legitimate leader of that particular society. But if we're to look at the potential ideas of what post-secularism allows us to do, then we see different conceptions of legitimacy which may be linked to particular cosmologies. So within Islam, killing another Muslim is a way to delegitimize somebody's authority. So really, bringing in religion, bringing in different cosmologies is a way of enriching international relations and decentering our very Eurocentric understandings of political community. By way of conclusion, my conclusion is really about human security. The challenge of human security is to articulate a difference, universality inclusive of difference, and a security that doesn't threaten the other. This is in a way contradictory, because any idea of universality can be seen as necessitating assimilation of others, making others like us. And any understanding of security always is presupposed on the idea that there are others who constitute external threats. However, I think that one way of taking the claims of human security seriously would be by, which have been exhausted within secular terms, can be furthered by engaging with different conceptions of universality found in religious traditions. So the point I'm trying to make is that universality is not the prerogative of a particular part of the world. Other cosmologies have different understandings of universality, competing and overlapping understandings of universality, which need to be taken into account. So part of the contradiction here is, as I argue in my book, for human security to aspire to universality, it needs to be post-secular. However, is the post-secular possible? And even if the post-secular is possible, will it lead to the fusion of horizons, which is Gadamer's phrase? So will we reach at a cultural understanding which will permit us to articulate a reworked or reconceptualized understanding of human security, which is inclusive of difference? This is a question. I certainly can't answer it. But I think it's a question which is conducive of an interesting discussion. And what I've tried to do is to suggest ways in which we can enrich international relations by breaking down the dichotomy between the secular and the religious, and looking at religious traditions and taking them seriously as political traditions, inclusive of politics. If you're interested, the rest of it's in the book.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. And so we do have until 8 o'clock for questions, discussion, answers. So has anybody got a question or a comment they would like to start with? And other people, if they have them, raise your arms and I can try and make a list and get as many people in as possible. Yes, sir.
I'm troubled by your discussion around religion and post-secularism and Judeo-Christianity as being secularism, almost suggesting that it's a sort of continuation of imperialism and colonialism, and overtly doing that. But I think that the, sort of the religion side, I think secularism, I would see that as something going across the piece, that's about not appealing to supernatural explanations for how life is ordered. And there's been sort of an awful lot of sometimes violent opposition by Judeo-Christianism to secularism. So I can't quite see it as a continuation. It may have arisen there first and spread there most, but that's a bit like saying that democracy is, makes us all Greek, because that's where it arose. So is there any validity in what I'm saying?
Do you want to take some questions?
I think people are still thinking, so okay. If you want to take that one, and then as people have questions, raise your hands and they'll come back to you.
Shall I answer it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Excellent point. I would agree, but the point I'm trying to make is that within any tradition there's contestation, but it's understanding what you're contesting. For a lot of people who are coming from different cosmological traditions, they don't really understand what really is happening. So the example I'll give will be a personal example of going to Japan, and this contestation. I can go to a faculty meeting and I can see that they're serious arguments, but I don't know what these arguments are about, because these arguments are articulated in terms which would say exclude me purposely, but I can't access what those arguments are about. So I think that if we look at ideas of, for example, pro-choice or pro-life within the United States of America, then there is at least an understanding that fundamentalist Christians or fundamentalists, fundamentalist Christians for sake of example, know what they're objecting to. Whereas for people in other cosmologies, it may be articulated in different terms. I don't know, but I'm not trying to suggest that there's no contestation, that these are, self-enclosed, homogeneous civilizations. What I'm trying to say is that there's a core there, which permits dialogue to happen. And if you don't know what the particular issue is, then you can't take a stance.
Yes.
So more practical. We have a immigration wave to Europe now in the past years. And my understanding is that Europe is somewhere quite xenophobic. Somewhere, especially in those places that aren't used to immigrants, like Romania, Bulgaria, and so on. And can you elaborate it more in this century or 20th century, 19th century, and then compare people's reaction and why perhaps sometimes somewhere they are quite against? I have my own question. If it's not thanks to the internet and Facebook, that people can have very different opinion, very different sort of information. But 20 years ago, you had three newspapers, you were either left or right. Now you can have thousands of opinions.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to. I haven't done the analysis on this. I wouldn't be able to compare attitudes to migration from different historical epochs. What I would say is that if we go back 100 years, the majority of if we look at migration flows, it was from Europe, from the West, to what was seen as the New World. They didn't need visas. They didn't need passports, and they came to colonize, to settle, etc. So I think we're looking at two different processes here. And my point is not that Europe is xenophobic. The point I'm trying to make is that migration permits us to rethink political communities. That really is the point I'm trying to make. We need to get away from the sort of binary of xenophobia and then acceptance. It's, you know, who do you accept? Why do you accept them? The idea that if somebody's accepted and they're still the other, this shows the limits of integration, in my view. But, well, valid questions.
Okay, we've got a few hands going up now, so do you want to take three questions or something? Yes? And then.
Because these matters don't really apply to God, they're about human interaction. So he took the advice, literary advice. And that's, many scholars point to that as an example of the willingness, like in Islam, to distinguish between secularism and the sacred. And, okay, so I just wanted to ask, what you see as, like, it's kind of ironic that as we come closer together in terms of human security, how can we encourage universality, because we see it in so many different
ways. Actually, I have two questions, if you don't mind.
I think we've got time, yeah.
Okay, so I'm from India, and so I have heard this argument before that the idea of secularism does not quite apply to all religions and cultures universally. And that doesn't necessarily mean that a particular culture is being orthodox or is completely exclusive and non-inclusive. But I've always had a trouble in kind of accepting or rationalizing that fact. And I want to know that how do you define secularism, and how does it become sort of like a exclusive sort of a, I mean, like, something that's relevant to a particular religion or culture more than the other. And my second question is that you also talked about how migration should be looked at as a global problem and not from the perspective of the nation states. But as of now, it is the nation states which are dealing with the problem of migration. So, I mean, how do you look at a problem globally when it is primarily the nation state which has to deal with?
Do you want to take one more? Yeah, one more.
Two very related questions. One is what happens to non-believers, and another one is one way to overcome that non-believers issue is probably to bring out the world society perspective, so basically a cosmopolitan. But if we bring that up, then probably we don't even need a post-secular understanding, because world society still serves as a universal community. And how do we talk about that?
Okay, I think that's enough for now, yeah?
Okay, could I take them in reverse order, if possible?
Go ahead, okay.
The world society perspective, this is what I'm trying to get away from by looking at human security. Human security is, a reiteration of the world society perspective, which looks at individuals rather than communities and nation states. The key problem is that individuals don't exist. We're products of social interaction. So in this sense, that this is one of the problems of a world society perspective. Your other point about non-believers, this is part of the problem which I can't really elaborate in a short sort of lecture. I'm not the sort of Christian fundamentalist advocating the Christianization of the rest of the world. What I'm saying is it's happened. You know, you're all Christianized. Well, at least some of you, if you have access to capital and you're over here. there have been processes of secularization and modernization which have impacted upon you. They've certainly impacted upon me. So it's not a question of belief. It's a question of what you understand by norms, what you understand by values. They come from somewhere. So belief is really not so important in the overall framework. I make that distinction between religious and faith, thick and thin religion. But what I'm really trying to look at is where these values come from. So, yeah, very good points about secularism. One thing which I thought about is secularism can be seen as a thinning down of religious norms. So belief in a particular, certainly belief in, if we look at Judeo-Christian, Abrahamic terms, ideas of belief of a transcendental God is not necessary. So I think the best way of understanding this is Charles Taylor's idea of an immanent frame. So an immanent, what Taylor tries to do in the secular age is to show how our understandings of secular are fundamentally different from the religiosity which existed within Europe 500 years ago. He only sees Europe. But at the same time, how they were built upon these processes. So it's a genealogy here of secularism. Talal Asad does that as well. So it's, you know, secular subjects, belief in a god or divinities or karma or dharma is maybe optional. It's conscious and unconscious belief. But at the same time, our values, our understanding of who we are is informed by these cosmological traditions. I think one example which I can give is when my father came to Japan, my father's Sikh. I was working in a university in Kyoto and we didn't have Christmas Day off. It was a remorselessly secular university. So they didn't like anything I was doing with religion. They couldn't understand it. They said, why don't you look at globalization? I said, that's boring. I said, do human security. That's fine. So he came there and he said, what? You don't have Christmas Day off? So Christmas Day, having Christmas Day as a holiday was seen as a, it was almost a right, you know, it was a violation of the vital core of my own existence that I had to work on Christmas Day. Now, I understood that basically, where is this coming from? If you're within Japan, you're secular. But why should Christmas Day be a holiday? This is just a facetious example. It's not really an important example, but it's an example of how something you take for granted actually emerges from a particular tradition. What I'm trying to say is there's really no such thing as a view from nowhere. And I think this brings me to the idea of universality. Excellent point. I don't know as much as you on the Islamic tradition. The only thing I would say is that maybe there is some sort of common understanding of universality from the Abrahamic traditions. So what about areas and parts of the world and different cosmologies which have plurality of different understandings of God? I'm not sure. There is universality, I think. It's an assumption to say there's universality in every tradition. I have no idea. But at the same time, that universality will take different forms. So the universality of Islam may be more intelligible for me if I come from a modern secular society where certain Judeo-Christian values are accepted as common sense. But they don't translate. They may not translate in parts of South Asia or even within Japan.
Aaron?
Thank you for this lecture. Good questions so far. I have two. I want to bring up the problem of the state again. We're looking at a post-secular human security, moving towards transformations of the concept of community. But do these transformations require a world order transformation as well? Do we require a change in the state-centric world order? And then second, I'm very interested in this Gadamerian fusion of horizons,
but I want to explore the location of that. Is that an everyday fusion? Are we talking about geopolitical levels of fusions or more state level regional? What about the location?
I really like your work here because it throws me off balance, and I like that. I mean, that's what a good scholarly work should do. I think I've got it about 80% right now. It's just a little bit different because I grew up American, and maybe this is in America, secularism is criticized all the time. And she and I both grew up in really conservative parts of the world.
What's criticized?
What
did you say is criticized?
Secularism.
This constant
discourse against secularism. Mm. But I'm starting to get it from your point of view, but that's just a comment. But where's gender in your argument? You've got all these other variables going around, and I kept wondering, you know, the gender purpose. So if you could say something about that.
Okay. I really enjoyed your talk, Giorgio, and I'm not giving you an easy bouncer. just one or two things. I think it is greatly important migration as part of human security. But I think in the presentation it would be helpful to make a distinction between migrants and settled minorities. And relating to that, I think the question that troubles me post-secular and operationalization of post-secular is that other than politics of recognition and the politics of difference, what alternatives minorities have to engage with the post-secular language? I mean, I give you concrete examples here, and you and I know these very well. How can one, for example, in the UK, translate into the post-secular, context, demands for Sharia among some sections of the Muslim community, or indeed the Sikhs' demands to carry long swords in public life. These are practical concerns, and you've dealt with them, you've written on them. So I think, in essence, we should not lose that perspective from the one of critical international relations of political science.
Okay.
Thank you very much for that, Bouncer. Yes, having read my work instinctively as my external examiner for my PhD, and somebody I'm writing a book on Sikh nationalism with, yeah, I think you know that I'm basing this on the idea of the politics of recognition. The focus, though, is on theoretical terms. I'm trying to get away from the Sikhs, so. And I don't see any problems with the Kirpans because Sikhs are very peaceful people. I think in terms of the options available, this doesn't really answer your question, but I think will perhaps help understand where we're coming from. I think one problem I have with a lot of contemporary post-structuralists, usually anthropology, is the understanding in which multiculturalism impacts upon the subjectivity of post-colonial people and communities. And if we look at the idea of Benedict Anderson's argument in terms of long-distance nationalism, how it somehow encourages minorities to think collectively and to think differently. The argument I'd like to make is that actually if you go back, to the 1950s or to the 1960s, if you wore a turban, you wouldn't get a job, or you'd only get certain jobs. And that it was a result of, as you mentioned, settled minorities, which I have not looked at within this lecture. It's a result of their political struggles that we have the multicultural space which allows us to pursue a politics of recognition within the UK. It had nothing to do with policy. It was contestation, struggles. So when I go to Japan, I realize that there isn't that presence. There aren't those settled minorities apart from, let's say, the Korean minorities. which allow there to be a politics of recognition. So I think the settled minorities is a very, very important point. But yes, I'm looking at it from the perspective of international relations. And this leads me to Aaron's point, very simply, yes, world order transformations. I look forward to your PhD thesis. Yeah. Correct. Fusion of horizons, values. I don't think fusion of horizons is gonna occur. That's where there's a question mark. Do I think it's desirable? Not if it results in assimilation, but if it contributes to the civilizing process, as Elias would say, maybe. But I'm deeply skeptical about the whole idea of fusion of horizons. Gender, yeah. What I'm trying to do is look, particularly in the slide on desecularizing human security, the limits of desecularization. See, part of the problem is I don't practice what I preach. I'm not really, you know, a believer in the sense of having a thick understanding of religiosity. So I don't know the extent to which, for example, patriarchy is embedded within religious traditions, or whether it's religious traditions which are embedded within patriarchy. So, for example, I listened to Zizek when he came here and gave his sort of public lecture here back in April. And he was equating religion with, you know, with violence against women, religion, violence against women, rapes, whatever. This sort of sensationalization of gender-based violence, which comes from, in his case, watching too many Tarantino movies. I'm not sure the extent to which it's religions which are patriarchy, the extent to which patriarchy itself is a structure. So Japan is a great example. If we're going to take the Japanese self-description of their polity as a secular society seriously, then how can you explain the World Economic Forum statistics, which say that there's greater gender inequality within Japan than there is within South Asia? Well, Rwanda is actually doing very well. I think it's within the top 10. So is this really about how religious a society is, or is it about patriarchy? I think that's it, isn't it?
That's it. Do you have any else? Yes?
I have a question about what you see as the practical application of human security. It seems to me a lot of these concepts have been around for a long time, but means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I know the UN Security Council has been talking about it for some time, but when you read their new papers, their long piece on there, that as well, it's a struggle because their ideas as they go through about what human security is, and one of the things they suggested was giving peacekeepers a little booklet that reminds them that people have rights to things like this, and it just seems so almost so laughable that you would have to, that's their idea of building food security into a security strategy. So I just wanted to know what you see the future of human security. Is it just one of these terms that's going to be used a lot and slip out of the way, or do you think there's a real practical application to the theoretical?
Do you have any more? Yeah. Oh, you've had one already, haven't you? Is anyone else waiting? Yeah, because you have had one, haven't you? You had a question. No, because someone else, at the back. Yeah, I'll come back to you later if no one else has their hand up. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. I'd just like you to elaborate slightly on, you made some points about your distaste for globalised neoliberal capitalism and indeed media oversimplification topics. And I'd like you to just sort of talk about how you can see a practical application for the kind of things you advocate, so respect of cultural particularity, non-translation. How do you see a practical application for those ideas in a world that seems increasingly to be going in a way that ideologically you oppose?
Okay. We don't have another. Do we have another one, or two? Should we let her have another question? Yeah.
Oh no! I'm just going back to the second question. How do you look at migration as a global.
Yes. Yeah, I missed that. Yeah. Shall I answer that one?
You seem to have a habit of going in reverse, so stick to it.
Okay.
That's fine.
I'm completely confused. Yeah. I didn't answer that question, so that's not really a second question. I had written something down. Your argument is that basically, how do we think of migration within systemic terms if it's basically the unit of the system, the nation state, which is dealing with migration? My argument is that the nation state itself is being reproduced by migration. So migration brings into question who is inside a particular political community and who is outside. So it reinforces the power of the state to decide who's in and who's out. It's about reproduction. If we look at I was going to make a really stupid comparison with children and parents, but it's not going to work. So I hope you get the point. I really didn't want to do all that one. On global neoliberalism, I don't know if I've read you correctly, but for example, if we look at Zizek's problems with ideas of what he would look at as the reification of cultural difference, is it does not permit the creation of class-based resistance to the practices of global capitalism. Global neoliberalism is a way of talking about the globalization of a particular form of capitalism, neoliberalism. The problem I'll have with that is that if you go back to the 20s and the 20s and the 30s, if you go back 20 or 30 years ago, there was an argument, particularly in the left, which argued that ideas of cultural difference were subsidiary to the primacy of a class-based struggle. Now, that struggle itself led to the experiment of communism and led to the reification of the state, of extremely secular states, and arguably human tragedy and greater human insecurity. I think it's very dangerous to... It makes opposition to global capitalism more difficult. But at the same time, there's a logic within the market which I wouldn't say is a secularizing logic, which brings people closer together who have similar class backgrounds or similar backgrounds with the productive system. This will perhaps lead to the creation of a conceptual language whereby they can relate to one another. However, you can't bypass the problem of cultural difference. What I want to get away from is the whole idea of false consciousness, the idea that people who are religious, for example, are practicing a form of false consciousness, and many of my Marxist friends have this sort of distinction between what is seen as the truth of history, which is mostly secular and modern, and the idea of outmoded feudal understandings of humanity. Yes, it makes opposition far more difficult, but I think it's a necessary process. And also, we should look at contestation within the different cultures.
Practical application.
I'm delighted by that question. I spent the weekend reading the Berlin report of the Human Security Study Group. It talked in terms of second-generation human security. I had a slide, but I didn't quite understand it. All it talked in terms of is local ownership, and local ownership means being sensitive to cultural difference. Being sensitive to cultural difference is very different from what I'm trying to get at. What I'm trying to get at is that our understanding of human security can only come from the local. There is no universalized understanding of human security. And when there is a universalized understanding of human security, it's usually internalized. So it's internalized and it's reproduced, fudonis. So human security, for example, in Japan is very simple. It's JICA, it's the Japan International Cooperation Agency. They go to a particular place and they want to make infrastructural investment possible. How do they make infrastructural investment possible? Well, there needs to be some tie-in with human security. So if the humans involved, that's fine. If there's some sort of security application, that's fine. But basically, it's development. It's official development assistance. Human security is a language which legitimizes that. When we think of practical applications for human security, this is the problem with human security. There cannot be any practical applications to human security. Human security can only emerge from within particular cultural boundaries or culturally contested understandings. Hopefully we'll get to a global understanding of human security one day, but it's still a process. So I think practical applications are, we're too soon to actually be implementing it.
Is there anyone else? At the back there?
So I think this is a really interesting example of a topic that's being discussed so widely at the moment in academic circles, but also just in among the general public, this question of religion and identity and security. And I think that you raised something really important when you mentioned your personal experience in Japan of wanting to be able to articulate in the language of the place that you're in that you are different and that that's fine, and that doesn't mean that you can't be part of that society without being designated an other. But we've talked really briefly about just the media representation being the complete opposite of that, at least in this country, and at the moment there being a real narrative in media and in politics that really doesn't acknowledge this idea that you can be different and yet part of the same society. So I guess my question is, how can we perhaps build on the fact that this is a topic that touches people, unlike a lot of things in politics and in academia, which never bridge into the public narrative. This is something that you can very easily talk to people about, because people have an opinion about whether different religions can bridge into one society and create a common identity. So that problem has already been overcome. I think that's not an issue with this. The issue is that belief that it's possible to create a society that has mutual identities living alongside each other. I guess how do you feel that, especially in the sort of current environment in the UK, we can cross over this narrative that is so common of creating this other and this divide, and try and bring these ideas that you mentioned of accepting that we don't need this false consciousness, but also it doesn't have to be either of the two extremes, basically. Does that make sense?
Okay, shall we let you have one last? Because you started off and you've been waiting. You want to come back? Come back. Okay, and that will probably be the last. Oh, was there one more at the back there? Okay.
Similar sort of theme. It was you mentioned along with human security rights and acceptance were two of the things that you didn't really expand on rights. And I was thinking that it's rights. With rights come responsibilities. Usually, and one of those might be sort of mutual acceptance, not only a ways to behave, ways not to behave. And also that there are rights. It's usually somebody's somebody ought to help, ought to deliver the consequence of those rights. But that actually transcends boundaries, not just with migrant communities, but also in the place that they started from. And then we get, we've just had a whole lot of wars, sort of loosely based on trying to intervene to, in this case, prevent democracy. That way also lies an awful lot of problems.
Okay, and I think I should ask you as well, because I didn't see right at the back, then that will be the last one. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
The fact is they're very divisive.
Yes.
In these religions, there's tremendous division.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you see that? How do you represent that in your situation?
That's a nice one to finish on then.
Yeah.
So you've got three there.
I think I tried to make that point when I showed the table of the different cosmologies. the point I was trying to make is I'm just trying to provincialize secular understandings. I'm not trying to reify these different cosmologies. What I would say is there are different ways of... there are different cosmologies out there, but I'm not trying to homogenize them or essentialize them. But let's not pretend that culture doesn't exist, that culture is not part of one's life. So I think we... That's, I mean, I want to sort of get away from the post-structuralist or liberal, or some liberal understandings of culture as something which is not important, the idea of a view from nowhere. Culture is important, but we can't homogenize it, I agree, and we can't essentialize it, but our values come from somewhere.
And then there's the question of scale. Yeah. Scale of the modern integration, trying to integrate so many at once, makes a difference. I mean, there are many different people from all around the world who come into this country and integrate and live different, you know, decades and get on fine with the locals. It's just at the moment there seems to be tremendous controversy.
But that's based on the idea of there being a nation state as the natural community of mankind, and that there'll always be a Britain and there's always be a Europe, and Europe will always have a Judeo-Christian sort of identity. The point I'm trying to make is that perhaps if we take post-secularism seriously, there are more Muslims within Europe than there are Danes or Swedes. So, you know, we have to take their cultural understandings and cultural values seriously. They are European. This is Tariq Ramadan's work. If we look at Western Muslims, they're Muslim and they're European. It's not a question of them having to assimilate to our cultural values. We have to also understand them. And that also leads me on to the idea of rights and responsibilities. I would agree with you, but I try to actually avoid using the term rights. Unfortunately, I failed. Yeah, I mean, human rights, it's just straight Protestantism 101. The idea of where rights come from. Even from Catholic backgrounds, rights don't make sense. You know, the idea that you have a right to something. You know, I tried to explain it to my daughter. She didn't understand. Well, I have a right. That means I'm free to do things. Why are you telling me what to do? And I think that's also the problem which you highlighted, which is, again, how do we export? As soon as we have these ideas, civilizational norms such as rights, then the key question is these others don't understand rights. They need to be empowered. They can be empowered. You know, how do we do this? By education, by ODA, by military intervention. The argument here I'm making is that perhaps we need, whoever we are, and don't understand who we are, we need to understand and listen to others. And maybe there are other understandings of rights, but I think security for me is more related to religion. I mean, particularly Judeo-Christian understandings of security. It's about faith as a form of security. If things go badly, there is maybe a world outside, or if not a world outside, there's a karma, there's some sort of cycle. It doesn't necessarily mean transcendence. But I think security makes a lot more sense than rights. That's my view.
Two minutes to say what we should be doing in Brexit Britain about this.
That's really simple for me to say. That's a great project. I'd like to listen to you. All I can say is public lectures at LSE. That's the only thing I can do, and that's more than I thought I could do. So that's me done. Now off to the.
It helps, I think, and I think we do have to wind up now. Thank you all for amazing questions. I'm just glad I didn't have to answer them. But you've done an amazing job, George, in answering questions and giving us a fantastic lecture. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.